From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the New Yorker science writer Elizabeth Culbert explored the American preoccupation with their lawns. She also profiled the anti-lawn movement. These are people who are critical of the amount of chemicals and water required to keep up what they see as a form of cultural conformity. Part of the criticism is also about the botanical trickery that's required to keep your lawn in line with the neighbors. Elizabeth Culbert says the way we're doing it now, we're keeping our lawns in this perpetual state of vegetable adolescence. We've just created a short film with the writer Michael Pollan who calls the lawn unnatural. And so today we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the American obsession with the lawn. Join us after the news.
Each morning as you drive the kids to school, KUER's Radio West team is preparing a new conversation that explores the way the world works. They connect with scholars, authors, and interesting people and delve into the questions that bring context and understanding so that when 9 o'clock rolls around, you can spend an hour expanding your mind and heart. Trusted voices powered by you. Support Radio West today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a piece for The New Yorker magazine a few years ago, the writer Elizabeth Culbert explored the American preoccupation with their lawns. There is about 63,000 square miles of turf in the United States. This is an expanse of Kentucky bluegrass and Bermuda and fescue that would cover an area larger than the state of Georgia. And here's another way of measuring this preoccupation. The lawn care industry in this country, it brings in nearly $80 billion a year. Culbert wrote that the lawn has become so much a part of the suburban landscape that it's difficult to see it as something that had to be invented, but it did. We just released a new Radio West film called The American Lawn with the food and nature writer Michael Pollan. So that's giving us a chance to rebroadcast our conversation with Elizabeth Culbert and others. It's about the natural and cultural history of the lawn. Culbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and we began our conversation with some history. A man named Andrew Jackson Downing. In 1841, he published a landscaping book, really the first of its kind. The American lawn then wasn't really a thing.
Well, if you believe him, and I guess there's no reason to disbelieve him, and there certainly are, you know, independent sources of information on this, it was pretty dismal. You know, village life was, you know, people had a lot of animals, and they didn't really have the luxury, I think, to, you know, landscape their yards. They were very concerned on trying to survive. So land that wasn't actually in productive use was either just, you know, allowed to just sort of whatever was there grew, or really often nothing grew, I think, is the fact of the matter. People had dirt yards, and sometimes they swept their dirt yards. But basically, they had, you know, either vegetable gardens near the door, or they had cropland, and also they used backyards such as they were also for the privy was in the backyard.
Right.
The garbage was in the backyard, so it wasn't really necessarily a pretty picture.
Yeah, did he at the time did he draw a connection between the American character, you know, moral character, and the way they kept their yard?
Absolutely, it was an age of many kinds of spiritually uplifting texts, and his is very much in that tradition. It's not just a book about, not just a practical how-to. It's about the beautiful, and the beautiful is capitalized, and it's about how gardening and making your surroundings beautiful is really a reflection of your soul and your character. And if we were to beautify our villages and towns, then, you know, the sort of general edification and uplift and moral uplift of the population would follow from that.
How much of an influence did Downing's ideas have on American society? You know, the way Americans would start to see landscaping.
Well, he had a tremendous influence. I mean, the book was, you know, sort of in its time. You'd call it a bestseller for a, you know, pretty heavy-duty book. And it went through something like 8 printings, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But it was in print for a long time. But even more so, you could argue, he had it. He died very young. He died in a tragic steamboat accident on the Hudson. His boat, he was on a boat. He was trying to go to New York, actually. He lived in up the Hudson in Newburgh, New York. And the steamboat raced another steamboat. That was apparently a popular thing to do. And it caught fire. So he died in an accident when he was 37. But he had a very, very influential protege, and that was Calvert Vaux, who went with Frederick Law Olmsted, designed Central Park, and designed many of the new suburbs of the mid to late 19th century. So they had a tremendous influence. So his influence, you know, sort of was passed down through some of his proteges.
So give us a sense, before we start talking about the sort of natural history and the cultural history of it, give us a sense of where we are today. How pervasive is the American lawn? I mean, obviously, it's the cultural norm in American landscaping.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few parts of the country, and, you know, you all, I mean, I live in the Northeast where we all have lawns. But even, you know, even where you all are, where it's, you know, very dry and where turf grass would not naturally grow without a great, and as you all know, keeping lawns in the high desert, it's not easy. So lawns are everywhere. You know, they're pretty much ubiquitous. Now, there are some parts of the country that are, you know, just so bone dry. For example, I was recently in Santa Fe. They do not have lawns in Santa Fe, and they have water restrictions right now. You really cannot have a lawn. And that is coming to an increasing number of places, I think.
How big an industry is this, the lawn industry?
Well, it's huge. I mean, between you know, all the lawn care services and just the local guys who cut people's lawns and then the big, huge lawn care companies and, you know, Scotts, which is selling you fertilizer and grass seed. And so, you know, it's a huge industry. And it also extends, of course, to turf that's on golf courses, which is, you know, very heavily treated. So it's a big deal.
You point out in the piece that a lawn has no productive value. That is, its function is mostly cultural. So, what is the symbol, I guess, that the lawn really has become in American society?
Well, that's an interesting question, and, you know, many people sort of have different views about that. I think it's pretty clear that when it was originated, it was a symbol of wealth because only the wealthy could afford it. It was very hard to keep it up. It was very hard. A lawn has to be mown. That's pretty much the definition of a lawn. And before you had, you know, power mowers, that was a big deal. So for a long time, it was just something that very wealthy people could have. And then it became a sort of a symbol of, you know, this communitarian project. And if you look at many American suburbs, they're laid out. There's no clear distinction between my yard and your yard, my front lawn and your front lawn. So everyone, you know, had to keep their lawn sort of at this uniform standard, or your lawn sort of stood out. So it became sort of a, you could argue, either a communitarian project or a conformist project, whatever you want to say. And nowadays, it's sort of hard to say what the lawn is because it's sort of just there. You know, like we all have, you know, a car in our driveway. We all have a lawn, and I think we've sort of stopped thinking about it on some level.
Do you you'd write a bit about the sort of anti-lawn movement? What's the vision that those who, and we'll talk about this more in depth as we go along, but what's the vision they have of a country full of these, you know, green swards of lawn? How are they seeing it? That it's this sort of mindless sense of, you know, conformity, basically?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's several critiques of the lawn that have been voiced, you know, very eloquently. And, you know, the first one, as I mentioned in the piece, you could really argue starts with Rachel Carson. And she tells these stories, and they're true. And if you go back and look at advertising, you know, from the 50s, it's sort of chilling, you know, of lawns that were drenched in DDT, chlordane, chemicals that are now banned. I mean, we simply do not allow them to be used. And they were, she tells the story about, you know, attaching a little thing to the garden hose so you could spray these things. So you were doubtless, you know, spraying yourself, too. And they killed just everything. They killed every insect, every earthworm.
Yeah.
And they were terribly destructive. So there's what we are putting on our lawns. I mean, if you just, you know, step back and think about that. People have estimated that per acre, on an acre-by-acre basis, we apply more pesticides and herbicides to our lawn than to our agricultural crops. So that's pretty serious. And over the years, we've used a lot of things on our lawns, as I say, that we now don't even allow people, you know, to touch. And then there's the habitat destruction argument. I mean, when you go out there in your lawn and you plant turf grass, which is not native to the U.S., so you're basically planting an invasive species, and then you're keeping it mowed, you're really preventing a lot of organisms, a lot of little animals, you know, that would live back there from doing so. So you're really destroying a lot of habitat. And the National Wildlife Federation, I think it is, has this program of, you know, turn your backyard back into habitat, into what the local flora and fauna can thrive in. So there's a habitat destruction argument. And then there's simply a waste of resources argument. And that's really serious, especially for people, lawns that are in dry areas, that, it's estimated in some parts of the country during the dry season, 60% of residential water is just going onto people's lawns. So that's huge, and that's a question of, you know, can we really afford to use water in that way anymore?
What do you think are the do you get a sense that these anti-lawn movements are catching on? You write about Laurie Otto, who was the founder of a group started in the 70s, I think, called Wild Ones.
Right.
They're trying to invert, I think you could say, invert the kind of accepted moral interpretation of the lawn, as opposed to looking at a well-kept lawn as being an indication of people who care. They're trying to sort of flip the idea and say,
right,
to somebody who didn't, in fact, care. How is that taking off? Is it catching on at all, are you sensing?
I don't think it's wildly catching on, to be really frank about it. Just walk through, you know, the nearest suburb, and I don't think you're gonna see a lot of people having very creative alternatives to the lawn. In fact, after my piece ran, I got a note from a guy that I just know very vaguely, but who lives in Florida, and he told me about ripping up their lawn and putting in plants that had attracted all these wonderful butterflies. And one of the neighbors sort of objected, and he keeps getting citations. You know, a lot of communities have these lawn laws on the books that they're called weed laws, but basically they sort of mandate, you know, how close you cut your grass and all sorts of things like that. So they really we have almost legally enforced conformity. And there has been some changes, especially, as I say, in parts of the world that are very dry, where we really can't afford, communities can't afford the water it takes to keep up all these lawns. There have been some changes in local ordinances, but many of these weed laws are still on the books, and so you can still, you know, get cited for basically, you know, doing something different with your lawn.
Have you come to a conclusion, Elizabeth, about, I mean, Laurie Otto uses the word evil in connection with having a lawn, and
yeah.
I'm wondering, because you asked this question in the piece, is having a lawn in a deep sense, is it unethical?
Well, I think that, you know, is a pretty strong, it's a pretty strong label to attach to, you know, a lot of things that we do that we just do sort of mindlessly. It's like buying the T-shirt and, you know, is the T-shirt made by some child labor in Indonesia or whatever. We are all part of these networks of relationships that unfortunately, implicate us in a lot of activities that, I suppose, in a very strict sense, yes, you could call unethical. I think it's probably going a bit overboard, to call the lawn unethical. I think just sort of unsought out might be a better word.
You write this, and we'll talk. We're going to talk about, as we go along, some alternatives to the lawn. But you say this in the piece, that to advocate a single replacement for the lawn is to risk reproducing the problem. What do you mean by that?
Well, precisely because the lawn is this uniform thing, you know, anyone can tell you, you know, what a lawn looks like, and you can get guides, and they're somewhat tailored region to region because there are different pests and things, but basically a lawn is a lawn is a lawn, and it's the same thing in California, it's the same thing up here in western Massachusetts, even though the climatic conditions are, you know, vastly different, and what would naturally grow is very, very different. So to say, okay, well, let's put in X, that really doesn't make sense. The whole point of people who have objected to the lawn is let's think about what is, you know, basically climatically appropriate to your region before just deciding to put in something else that doesn't actually, you know, really grow very well in your region or requires a great deal of water or fertilizer or you know, pesticides to keep going.
You ask an interesting question in the story. If Andrew Jackson Downing were to come back today, what would he think of our lawns? You think he might be a little ambivalent about the question?
Well, I think that he had very high, you know, this is sort of inferring from his own writings, he had very high aspirations for us, and he, as we were talking about at the top of the show, he wanted people to sort of aspire to, you know, self-improvement, and it's hard to really see how, you know, just sort of this unsought-out landscape that we just do basically at this point because it's easy and because everyone else does it, how that's really, you know, sort of contributing to the betterment of our spirits at this point.
It's Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. There's a link to her article. It's called Turf War on our website, radiowest.org. And while you're there, you should check out the short film we made with the writer Michael Pollan. It's called American Lawn. You can watch it and share it and even share pictures of your own lawn, the good and the bad, at radiowest.org. We'll take a brief break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had a few years ago about the American lawn. That is to say, our preoccupation with our lawns. We originally aired this in 2008, but since then, the lawn has actually become the largest crop in the country. It's three times larger than corn. Of course, there is an anti-lawn movement as well, asking questions about the amount of water and chemicals that it takes to keep yourself in good graces with your neighbors. In fact, we've just created a short film about the American lawn. It features the writer Michael Pollan, so it's giving us an opportunity to rebroadcast this conversation about the cultural history of the lawn. Ted Steinberg joined us. He's a professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University. He's the author of a number of books, among them American Green: The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. Let me ask you, give us your sense, first of all. You write in your book that the rise of the lawn to, you know, sort of its dominance now in suburbia is one of the most profound transformations of the landscape in American history. What do you mean by that? I mean, how profound is that transformation?
Well, I think it's very profound when you think about the incredible amount of resources that we put into lawns, financial and natural and otherwise. I mean, lawn care is about a $40 billion business. The last I checked when I wrote the book a couple of years ago, it may have grown or even perhaps shrunk slightly since then. But in any case, it's huge. That's roughly the size of the gross domestic product of the entire nation of Vietnam. So on that score, I'd say that's a pretty profound amount of money at the very least. In terms of resources, the same holds. The amount of water that it takes to sustain, say, a 1,000 square feet of Kentucky bluegrass in California is something – coastal California is something on the order of about 27,000 gallons of water per year. And that's significant, just to keep something green.
So, what was our culture like? Well, I guess we'll talk about the sort of specific, the physical aspects of, you know, the American landscape before. But culturally, how did we think about landscaping? How did we think about our yards, about, you know, nature in that sense before the American lawn?
Well, what I write about in the book is the perfect lawn.
Yeah.
That's what I've looked at historically. Lawns go way back in American history. Washington and Jefferson had lawns, for example. There were lawns. There was sort of a surge in lawn culture, if you will, during the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century with the growth of suburbanization. But what kinds of lawns were these early lawns? Well, they weren't perfect lawns, and by that I mean weed-free, super green, ultra-trim turf. That came along later. These earlier lawns were full of clover, plantain, moss, all kinds of things. People weren't using a raft of chemicals on them for the most part. They were throwing manure on them for fertilizer. It's only in the post-World War II period that the perfect lawn rises to dominance. And by that, I mean something that's weed-free and super green, and that's dependent on all kinds of chemical inputs and a tremendous amount of water.
You write about in your book the lawn being a part of the family tradition. Your own father took, as you say, a deep pleasure in his lawn. It's almost become sort of a cultural, I don't know, a tradition. And you in fact say in the book that it's your lawn was the single most important engagement you had with the natural world. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I grew up not really all that far from Levittown, the iconic suburban development out on Long Island. I grew up in the town of Merrick. We had a lawn. I didn't really when I went outside, I mean, this is what I was faced with. I mean, by that, I mean, this is where I played, from, you know, digging in the yard to throwing the ball around, which I did just about every day when the weather was good. And then when I got older and became a teenager, I was faced with actually taking care of the bloody thing, mowing it. My father gave me this. We didn't have an electric edger, so he gave me this long-handled, medieval-looking device for hacking away the clumps of turf that edged over onto the sidewalk. We had these little clippers that I was supposed to clip around the lamppost with. So, yeah, I think it's very fair to say that this was the most important engagement I had personally with the natural world. Sure.
So what is the – I asked this of Elizabeth Colbert earlier. What kind of a cultural signal is a lawn today? That is to say, what does it represent beyond just kind of a, you know, something green and thick and pretty?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you are. I mean, if you're asking what does a perfect lawn represent, I'm not sure how to answer that exactly. I mean, some of my neighbors are very much into the perfect lawn business. I suppose we're supposed to think maybe that if they can get it together, as it were, and orchestrate perfection on the outside of the house, then presumably things on the inside of the house are just as perfect. Mm-hmm. At least that's one interpretation. Myself, I don't have a perfect lawn by any means. It's a low maintenance lawn. I've got clover, bluegrass, rye, moss, plantain, all kinds of things growing in there, and I don't water in the summer. So it's slowly starting to go brown now. I mean, what does that say about me, that I don't go to the dry cleaners regularly enough? I mean, perhaps.
You know, I like the way you explore the sort of human fixation with green. You say that, and you sort of explore some of these theories about why it is we are so comforted by a lawn. And you say one of the leading theories is that we have this sort of genetic predisposition to grass, to a lawn, one that you don't buy. But what is the theory that you hear?
Well, I think, and you're right, I don't buy it. But one theory as to why Americans love grass is that, well, you know, after all, human beings evolved in Africa on the savannah. And somehow, don't ask me how, this love for open grassy expanses was imprinted on the genes through evolution. Mm. I don't buy it. I mean, at least in the sense that if the grass on the African savanna is neither green nor short. So I don't think the perfect lawn, at least, is by any means something that's genetically programmed. In fact, I'm at great pains in my book to show that it's the result not of genetics at all, but of the result of larger economic imperatives, cultural forces, and so forth.
Ted Steinberg is with us. His book is called American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. Let's go to the phone. Dave is with us, calling from Fairview, Utah. Dave, welcome.
Hello, Doug. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your previous guest characterized lawn as non-functional, and I guess technically that's true. But like art, which I guess you could also characterize as non-functional, I believe that some greenery around us as humans is as essential as artwork. The question is whether or not a person needs acres and acres and acres of it in the desert to be continue to be human, which I disagree with. We just built ourselves a straw bale home in Fairview, which we found the local municipalities quite cooperative with that. And they have also been quite cooperative with us merely putting in about 300 square feet of lawn, whereas the rest of the yard is in gravel. I think it's kind of irresponsible for people, especially in Utah, to have acres and acres of grass. It just doesn't make any sense at all. And it seems to support a culture that you see all over this nation, which says, if we can, if we're financially able to do something, then by golly, we're entitled to do it. And I think that just needs to change over time.
Ted Steinberg, you want to react to that?
Well, I mean, I think I agree to a large extent with your listener there. I mean, I think what you see with these perfect lawns and the ones in my neighborhood might not take up acres and acres, but they're incredibly chemically intensive per square foot. I mean, they're planting creeping bentgrass, which is the same species that you'd find on a golf course. It requires all kinds of chemical inputs. It requires all kinds of water, which then leach these chemical inputs out, especially the fertilizer, and then right back with more chemical inputs and so forth. There is something, maybe irresponsible about that. The question is, you know, why are they doing this kind of thing, and can they stop?
Dave, glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Eric is with us. Eric's in Tremont, Utah. Eric, hi.
Hello. There was a comment earlier, again, to address one of your earlier callers, the no productive value of a lawn and that the function is mostly cultural, and I think that's kind of something that's been perpetuated by some of these people that are anti-lawn. But if you look at environmental benefits, a 5,000-square-foot lawn, which is about the average size here in Utah, provides enough people or enough oxygen for 8 adults daily to breed. In addition to that, a cooling factor around a housing development, a green landscape will decrease the outside temperatures of a home, which then in turn decreases the internal temperatures, which saves energy. By doing that, lawns can be great for erosion controls. And in addition to that, I mean, a sense of well-being can be achieved by actually maintaining a landscape and being able to control your environment around you. I grew up on a farm when I was younger, and, I learned how to work alongside my dad, being actually out feeling the soil and everything like that. And I think with suburbanization that this is one way that we can continue to be able to teach that kind of a process that of how to control ourselves. We learn that by controlling the things that are around us, but controlling the inputs that go into us. And I think that those kind of benefits then can also be derived by having a lawn. I agree that the water is a precious resource and that we need to conserve it as such. But also I feel like there's a lot of misinformation out there, and that education can actually help people, you know, education on how to take care of plants.
Let me get Ted Steinberg to react to this. Elizabeth Colbert, in her piece, talks about the lawn as really having no productive value. And we talked about that a little bit with her. She says its function is kind of cultural. What do you make of that? And respond, if you would, to Eric.
Well, you've raised two issues here.
Yeah.
I mean, one I can deal with very quickly. Maybe no productive value, but the lawn does have some utilitarian value. I mean, for example, I mean, I just told you, I mean, as a child, I played on the lawn all the time.
Yeah.
My own kids and I, we throw the ball around on the lawn just about every day.
Sure.
When the weather is good. So it does have value to us personally, and I suspect to other people as well. But again, what kind of lawn are we talking about here? I mean, I have a very low maintenance lawn, not a perfect lawn. And people that tend to have perfect lawns are not usually seen throwing around the baseball on their front yards, because that kind of wear and tear, of course, eats into the perfection. So that's one issue. With respect to what your listener is talking about there, let me say I'm all for education, and as a university professor, and I think we should be clear here. The lawn does have certain advantages. A dense stand of vegetation around your house contributes to the health of the watershed. It helps to cut down on stormwater runoff and erosion. That's all good. A perfect lawn, however, is another story altogether. And this canard that's been going around about oxygen that your listener mentioned, that goes back all the way to the first Earth Day in 1970. Scots, in order to climb on the Earth Day bandwagon, started talking about how the long helps improve the oxygen content of the atmosphere. This is silliness. When was the last time you opened up the papers and read big headline, "World has oxygen problem"? This is absolutely ludicrous and silly. So I think we need to talk about educating people about having a dense stand of vegetation around their yard, but to bring up some of these things that that the lawn warriors, as it were, are bringing up and continue to bring up, by the way, is just silly.
Well, it seems that sort of the I don't know how you'd put it, sort of the commercial propaganda is sort of a part of the way we talk about the American lawn. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that lawns didn't used to be the perfect lawn. I'll guess they'll make that distinction because it's important. Lawns didn't used to be this monoculture. I mean, a lawn, as you say, as yours is, has had a lot of clover in it and other kinds of things. But at some point, and you talk about I think it was the Scots company, it sort of eating into their market dominance, and that's when we came up with, I guess, fertilizer and other kinds of things. Talk about that.
Well, this is a very, very complicated process. That is to say, how what was essentially a low maintenance lawn was transformed into a high maintenance perfect lawn like we had today. And there were a lot of forces at work here. And part of them were clearly economic imperatives. That's something that Elizabeth Colbert in her piece in the New Yorker says almost nothing about, which is a little odd, I think. I mean, I think the Scots Company was mentioned once. Now, that probably has something to do with the fact that the New Yorker lives and dies by its advertising revenue, would be my guess. But you can ask her that if you have her back on the show. But there's absolutely no question in my mind that if you look at the history of the perfect lawn, that the Scots Company played a tremendous outsized role here with respect to engineering a perfect turf aesthetic. Now, I'm not talking here about a conspiracy or any such thing. The Scots Company is doing what it's obligated to do as a corporation, which is to make money for its shareholders. And it found the perfect way to do this, to sell Americans not on grass, but to sell them a lawn, an image, and a dream that was greater than the sum of its parts. And their path to selling people this dream was through lots of chemical inputs. That's how they make their money, by the application, by the sale of as many applications as possible. So there's no question that that's one element to the rise of perfection in lawn care. And there were other things going on as well in the 1950s. For example, trends in brightly colored consumer products were all the rage in the 1950s. Yellow pants, pink Cadillacs, this kind of thing. And a perfectly green lawn fit in with this trend as well, the cultural trend, suggesting that the homeowner in question with these brightly colored products and a brightly colored lawn, as it were forward-looking, modern-day Americans. So those are at least two things that are going on. And in fact, there are lots of other things going on that explain why the perfect lawn rose to dominance when it did in the post-war period, especially in the 1950s.
Colin is with us in Charlottesville, Virginia. Colin, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Hi. I have a question, which is the rise of the perfect lawn, does it coincide with the decline of the American backyard vegetable garden?
Yeah, I think by and large it does. You can find working class people, for example, in suburbs, in various suburbs across the United States, microfarming their property well into the 1940s. And by that, I mean planting vegetable gardens, as you say, and also raising small animals, chicken, geese, rabbits, in the front and the backyard. So there was, these early yards were had certain productive value for putting food on the table for working class people. There's no question about it. And of course, yes, I mean, what you see as with the spread of more and more lawn, and especially with perfect lawn, is less and less in the way of vegetable gardens. And, of course, that's sort of changing now. The perfect lawn has, of course, in the last several years entered a very vulnerable period in its history.
It's Ted Steinberg. He's a professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University, author of the book American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. I should also say that this is a rebroadcast of our earlier conversation, and that $40 billion figure that he cited earlier about the lawn industry, it's almost doubled. We've just posted a new film with the writer Michael Pollan reflecting on our complicated relationship with all that grass, and you can watch it. And we're also inviting you to share pictures of your own lawn at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about the American lawn. We're talking with Ted Steinberg, a professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University. He has a book called American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. Ted Steinberg, why are Americans so obsessed with their lawns? Have you, did you find an answer?
Well, I mean, I think there are lots of reasons why they continue to be obsessed with them. I alluded earlier in the broadcast to some of the reasons why the perfect lawn rose to dominance, having to do with, as I said, various economic imperatives, the business history of the Scotts Company, trends in color, also architectural trends are very important in understanding the rise of perfect turf and the obsession with it. And by that, I mean and this happens during the 1950s. There's a kind of blurring of the between indoor and outdoor space. The lawn became, and this is a quote from a lawn care book from the 50s, the lawn became the equivalent of your outdoor living room. And just like the 1950s, 60s living room was to be neat, clean, plastic over the sofa, while the outdoor lawn was to be perfectly groomed. The clippings were to be picked up and put in plastic bags and that kind of thing. So all these trends come together in the 1950s and lead to this obsession with perfection. And then I think the question becomes, well, why has it continued to be such an obsession for Americans? And I think it's related in part to structural forces, economic forces, for example, the saturation in the market for agricultural chemicals, pesticides and so forth, makes lawn care a real growth field for those in the chemical lawn care business. That's one thing that's going on. Lawns of perfect lawns are seem to be tied to property values, or at least people's understanding of the of what a good property looks like. They're also a form of these days of neighborhood cohesion. The sense that if you're not taking care of your yard, at least in one way or another, then you're not a good citizen. You're not a good upstanding member of the neighborhood. And then I think finally, this obsession is still with us because it's mandated by law. And earlier in your broadcast, when you were talking to Elizabeth Colbert, she mentioned weed laws. They're actually a little bit more complicated than she says. I mean, there are weed laws and then there are distinct grass height laws, which limit the height of the grass itself. And these things, of course, these kinds of ordinances, which are on the books all over in the United States and now also codified in homeowners association rules, limit the kinds of yards that Americans can have.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting if you think about the way we just look at fashion, sort of the cultural sensibilities today compared to, you know, the time when Eisenhower, you know, was president. I mean, we're a more, I won't say unkempt, but, you know, it's fashionable to leave your face unshaven entirely. People untuck their shirts. There's, you know, casual Fridays. Do you see the same sensibility being a little bit more acceptable of a lawn that has a little bit of clover in it? I mean, are you seeing that transformation at all?
Well, I can only really speak for myself.
Yeah.
Frankly, you know, I don't wear a jacket and tie to work. I don't think it's necessary. I don't visit the dry cleaners very often, to be quite honest, unlike my neighbors. I don't think that reflects
badly upon me at all, and I have a lawn that uses many fewer chemical inputs than the lawns of many of my neighbors. And I, frankly, I think that that's a good thing. I can't speak to the, to a more general cultural trend. I've just not studied it.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Mark is with us. Mark's calling from Salt Lake. Mark, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You'd appreciate this. I'm having a driveway moment. I have daylilies on the front porch that need to be planted, and I have a yard service I'm looking at through my rearview mirror.
Good.
My question, because I was listening to some of the earlier speakers, and they kind of stole my thunder. But I suppose the question I have is, are we drawing a distinction between lawn and garden? Meaning that lawn might be viewed as the culprit these days, the water bandit. And really, isn't it all about balance? You know, where we're in an arid climate and we should be dealing with a lot less lawn. Maybe the lawn up front for the parking strip for conformity to the community, but, you know, getting rid of the rest of that lawn and replacing it with what would be called a garden.
Ted Steinberg?
Well, I'm not I don't consider myself part of the anti-lawn faction, if you will, if there are factions here, and I guess there are. I agree. I mean, we need to have more plurality when it comes to the yard, which is to say, you know, one of the worst things that's happened as a result of the rise of the perfect turf aesthetic is that Americans are alienated from the yards by, in other words, buying into this corporate understanding of, well, I've got to get out there and I've got to put down weed and feed however many times a season, and I've got to get out there and run the water and mow it every week and the rest of this sort of thing. We've literally cut ourselves off from a kind of intimate knowledge and understanding of what goes on out there on the ground itself. And I think anything that we can do to reconnect Americans with their yards, I think, is a positive, a very positive direction to go in.
Hmm. Mark, glad you called. Bill is with us. He's in Brigham City, Utah. Bill, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, a comment and a question. My wife's from northern Minnesota, and where they're from, if it's green, they let it grow. It doesn't matter what it is. So is the perfect lawn a regional thing? And then also, I have a half-acre lot, and it's all grass, and I just assume have it will be something I don't have to mow. But it seems overwhelming labor-wise and money-wise to switch over to something that's, I guess, more eco-friendly. And you have any suggestions as far as that goes?
Let's start with the regional question first. Is it a regional thing? It seems a pretty universal concept having a – I guess you can find the perfect lawn everywhere in the United States, right, the concept?
Absolutely. You can find the perfect lawn everywhere in the United States, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
And it's not an accident that this has happened. If you take a look, the Scotts Company was very clever in its marketing strategy. Early on, they started publishing a magazine called Lawn Care. They didn't call it grass care because they figured they'd never be able to sell people on grass.
Right.
But they, as I said, could sell people, they thought at least, on the dream of something that was larger than the sum of its parts, of a lawn as a portal to upward mobility and that kind of thing. And they were very clever in what they did. Very early on, the company actually issued multiple different editions of Lawn Care magazine, depending on which region they were targeting, and thus encouraging perfection and tailoring their recipe for perfection in lawn care depending on the region that they were sending the lawn care letter out to. And by the way, they gave that lawn care letter away absolutely free to consumers so that they could figure out how to use all these chemicals that they were selling. So yeah, the perfect lawn is and one of the big problems here is that we're taking an exotic species an import essentially and we're planting it in places where it simply doesn't belong. I mean, there's no reason to plant Kentucky bluegrass, a cool season species, in the middle of a desert in California. I mean, in other parts of the American West, which is, as you know, very, very arid.
Let's go back to the phones. Jason is with us in Salt Lake. Jason, welcome.
Thanks, Doug, for taking my call.
Sure.
Your previous caller talked about northern Minnesota and how it stays really green. I spent 3 weeks up there, and it does stay incredibly green and is they get a lot of rainfall. I come from Jacksonville, Florida. I lived there most of my life, and my brother and I ran a lawn care service, and most everyone's lawn was green, and just with the humidity alone, which can be impressive in Florida, they would stay green and it would grow, pretty easily. But I have to laugh living here in Utah. I see how obsessive even my own, neighbors are on their grass, totally disregarding calls for watering every 3 days. Don't water during windy times. They're watering every day. They're watering windy times during the middle of the day, which they're just not exercising common sense. And I really believe it's a case of, with a lot of people, a case of keeping up with the Joneses. My grass has to be greener than your grass. My car has to be nicer and cleaner than your car. My house has to be, the whole song and dance.
Yeah.
I just think it's a case of keeping up with the Joneses. We live in what a meteorologist said the other day, in the second driest state in the Union, second only to Nevada. You're going to have brown spots, and just accept the fact that we live in an arid state and you're not going to have a perfect lawn unless you go to these obsessive lengths.
Yeah. Ted Steinberg?
Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, as I say in the book, get used to brown. It's not such a bad color. I mean, and my lawn's turning brown at this very moment, and I'm saving an awful lot of water allowing it to do so. So I don't see that there's any problem with that. And with respect to keeping up with the Joneses, well, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of ways to keep up with the Joneses. I mean, one way is to sort of move into a different league. I mean, and talked earlier in the program about people that are doing all kinds of different things with their lawn. They're making them into edible estates. They're planting food crops out there. There's all kinds of things you could do with your yard and still keep up with the Joneses.
Jason, glad you called. Thanks very much. Here's an email from Jess, who writes, with the recent remodeling of the Capitol building in Salt Lake City, they managed to tear up the entire lawn, and then they relaid the sod without taking into consideration xeriscaping options. Don't get me wrong, Jess writes, but I think some amount of lawn is okay. But what are your thoughts about the other options? And this, it was something that Bill, an earlier caller, had raised, this question of xeriscaping. I'm not sure if you've looked much into xeriscaping as an option, but I guess these, Ted Steinberg, should be regional alternatives, right? You should take into account where you live.
Yeah, that's exactly my point in the book, and I know a little bit about xeriscaping, but the single biggest problem with the lawn is that, again, we've taken an exotic species, something that did not evolve here, but in other parts of the world, bluegrass, for example, Northern Europe, zoysia, Eastern Asia, and these various other species, and we've just simply unfurled them across the North American landscape with very little regard to where we are. I mean, bluegrass works great if you're living in Newfoundland, and in fact, there's a town there, I believe, that's called Lawn. But if you're trying to grow bluegrass and you're living in an arid part of the American West, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So there's got to be some sense here of what plants grow well in a particular region and consideration of that when planting a yard.
Let's go back to the phones. Chris is with us in Salt Lake. Chris, welcome.
Thank you. My question was, how does the prospect of artificial sod play into our lawn?
Ted Steinberg?
Well, I mean, artificial turf goes back to the 1960s, 1966 or so.
There's a great section about that in your
book.
There
are a lot of people that are putting in artificial turf, synthetic turf, putting greens in their yards. I'm not sure that the question here is, what's the science of artificial turf?
Right.
I mean, in other words, is it a good thing ecologically to put in artificial turf? This stuff is essentially a petroleum product. I can see some problems with it. For example, real grass, I'm talking about a well-managed stand of grass. It doesn't absorb water. So it doesn't filter it. So it doesn't play the same positive role in the watershed that a healthy turf grass lawn would have. So, you know, my guess is that you don't want everybody running around now planting artificial turf in their front and backyards. That would be probably an unmitigated ecological disaster because it's impervious to water.
You say in your book, Ted Steinberg, you say, as you've said in the show, you have a lawn. You like your lawn just fine. You're just not inclined to worship it like some sacred site. Is that sort of part of it, that we ought to be start rethinking about it, that it's nice, it can be lovely, you can accept it being imperfect, you can, as you say, come to terms with brown, and it can be fine. You don't have to reject it entirely, but we just sort of have to rethink the way we're thinking about the lawn, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I that's exactly how I would have put it. There's no reason to invest it with all kinds of moral valence or any such thing. It's a piece of ground that I try to manage in a way that I think is ecologically intelligent. I call it kind of an enlightenment lawn. What I've got going, and I think the key point for listeners to understand is you really want to liberate yourself from the kind of corporate paradigm of these multiple chemical applications 4 or 5 times a year. There's really absolutely no need for that.
Ted Steinberg is the author of the book American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. We've just created a new short film we're calling The American Lawn. It features the food and nature writer Michael Pollan. You can see it if you head over to radiowest.org. And while you're there, we hope you will upload a picture of your own lawn. The good ones, the bad ones, we don't care. Go to radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our films are produced by Kelsey Moore. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Aileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.